As the number of lines of code increase, the number of vulnerabilities increase exponentially. And it shouldn't shock you, or maybe it does shock you, that when you look at security development life cycles, one of the companies that sort of pushes, pioneered, and does a lot of work in this space is Microsoft. And I know it's one of those that I think it's sort of like that memo that says security people must hate the cloud. It's almost like there was a memo that security people must hate Microsoft. Now, yes, if we were still dealing with Windows ME, I know some of you had to go through lots of therapy on that one. I could see us having that, but come on. Over the last several years, Microsoft has really done a lot with security. If you look at Windows 7, Windows 8, and Windows 9, they are pretty darn secure. They are pretty darn locked down compared to other pieces. So Microsoft has done a lot in this space, and they basically have gone in and they've come up with their security development lifecycle that's basically 16 different practices. So you have your training to make sure everyone has the right skills. You do your requirements definition. You do your design. You do your implementation. You do your verification. You do your release. And then you respond to any new bugs or issues that are out there. So now, as you go through this, security is engaged in each one of those different areas. And hopefully, these all look familiar because it's everything we've been covering this week. So during requirements, you're going in and establishing your requirements. Design, you're looking at your attack surface and threat modeling. Implementation, you're doing your static analysis. Verification, you're doing your model, is utilizing objects. I didn't say we weren't covering objects, I just said not 20 slides. So the idea of an object is you have these independent objects that get compiled together at runtime to perform functionality of a system. Now, here's the nice thing about using this in a distributed environment. If I go in and every single one of my applications that I write needs a menu, if I write separate code to do the menu, or even if I write the code once and copy and paste it into all my code and I compile it in, if I have 40 programs and I need to update the menu, or I need to change the menu, or there's a bug in the menu, I have to change 40 pieces of code. I have to retest 40 pieces of code, and that's a lot of work. So the idea is, why don't I go in and write a menu object, store it in one spot on the network, and then when all these applications run, they remotely pull it down and compile it in at runtime. Now, if I need to update, change, or alter the menu, I do it in one spot, and the next time you run the program, it automatically gets the new update code. So that's sort of the general idea here. And Microsoft, of course, has their approach, which is their object linking and embedding, which led to COM, with sharing of objects locally. Then you had COM Plus, which was peer-to-peer sharing. And then you had DCOM, which was centralized sharing, that led to .NET, and the WCF, which is their cloud-based sharing. And then you have Microsoft solution, and you also have your industry common object request brokering architecture, or CORBA, which is a vendor-independent standard that will also allow the sharing of objects to once again ease the development of code. Peer-to-peer is basically each system equally interacts with any other system. So at any point, your system can be either a client if it's requesting information, or a server if it's providing information. Now, peer-to-peer is more flexible because any system can act as client or server, but it's also harder because basically you're not controlling the endpoint, who is the user. So the user is basically running their own mini server in a peer-to-peer environment and could control, impact the overall security. Now, a few of the terms that we hear out there that I want to make sure we're clear on is you hear open source and closed source and full disclosure and limited disclosure. Let's start with the first one. Open source and closed source is not free and commercial. That is one of the big, big mistakes. Open source means the source code is provided to you, and closed source means the source code is not. Now, there are commercial open source applications, and there are free closed source applications. So it's not whether you're paying for it or not, it's whether you're getting the source code to be able to verify, validate, or update the code. And the reason why commercial vendors will go in and provide source code is because you can verify and validate it and get a higher level of security. So the open versus closed has nothing to do with whether you're paying or not. It's whether the source code is available for you to analyze and validate. Full disclosure is going in and disclosing security issues to force vendors to have to go in and fix their code. So in a full disclosure, if I find a vulnerability in Microsoft's code, I'm going to go in and publicly release it. And now because I'm publicly releasing it and everyone's aware, Microsoft is now forced to have to go in and fix that code. Closed disclosure is where I notify Microsoft. I wait for Microsoft to release a fix, and then I announce it publicly to society after there is a fix available. Now, once again, lots of debate out there that we're not going to get into for the exam, but you just need to recognize if somebody is going in and publicly releasing exploits or exposures before there's a fix, that is going to be full disclosure. If I'm notifying the vendor and waiting for them to fix it before I release it, then that's closed disclosure. When we look at our general security principles, we want to limit and control authorization of who's allowed to access what information. Also, another ISC squared golden rule. The number one way to reduce risk in code development is to perform code reviews. The number one way to reduce risk in writing code is perform code reviews. If you get a question on the exam and you go in and it says, what is the number one way to go in and reduce risk with writing code, what's the answer? Securely store the code. Oh, sorry. Too close? Sorry. Come on, we gotta have fun, right? We gotta laugh. We spent enough time together. I couldn't resist that one. I was gonna go for data owner, but I wasn't sure if that would be too good there, right? So sorry. Hey, at least I gotta laugh, right? So that's good. So code review is the number one way to reduce risk in software development. That is one that you just gotta sort of burn in your brain, because if you start looking at the answers they give you, you might convince yourself otherwise, right? Code review is the best way, according to ISC squared, to reduce risk. We also want to avoid conflict of interest situations, and we want to go in and perform separation of duties. Developers should never have access to production code. Developers should never be directly altering or changing production code. If there is a change, I don't care how small it is, you go through the change control board, you get approval, you develop it, and you roll it out, but you never go in and directly touch or modify production code on a system. You also want to have detailed logging and always have individual accounts. You never use shared accounts, because shared accounts, you can't hold people accountable for their actions, and you always want to give somebody the least amount of access they need to do their job. Now, some vulnerabilities that we sort of briefly discussed, but I want to hit hard to make sure you understand them, is I did show you buffer overflow. Hopefully did a pretty good job with that, but privilege escalation and integer overflow, we didn't really cover as much in domain 3. So I want to go in and just hit on those 3, because those are important vulnerabilities that are often exploited by adversaries.